Pollito de lunes a jueves.
The Safari Park. You're killing me, Larry.
Hello, Larry.
Hats off to Larry.
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 Larry. Larry, get into bed now.
Is there no sweeter sound than that of your own name buried in applause and cheers? I think not. School. For some it was love, some it was hate, most it was somewhere in between. I really do believe in that kismet thing of some strange energy in the ether, the way thoughts do travel, because I've been thinking of doing a show about school for a while. And I just got a voicemail from a listener asking for advice on continuing education, which we'll get to a little bit later. But maybe the most lasting opinions about school are the ones formed the earliest. I went to a Catholic grammar school in New York, and if my kids set foot in there now, they'd want me to accompany them, armed. It would be hard to say which was highest, the gloom factor, the creep factor, or the fear factor. My first day in grade school, Mom walked me and my brother, who was a third grader, to school and got me situated. It was a horror show. They should have had a sign over the keystone at the entrance to that school saying, "Abandon all hope, ye who enter here." The school was decrepit, ancient, built early 1900s. The granite steps had seen so many Oxford shoes, they were all worn down so that they were bowed like hammocks. The hallways were dark, barely lit by dim fixtures. It was almost like descending into a mine. The place smelled like disinfectant and rotting wood, musty and damp and dank, and the sound, always a susurrus of prayers and muffled cries and recitations of arithmetic and rote learning. The classroom had a color scheme, kind of like, well, San Quentin. Chalkboards and splintery wooden floors, wooden desks, bolted to the floor with flip-down seats. And these big double-hung windows that they worked with a window pole that resembled a boat hook. It was monochromatic, shades of gray. There was not one thing in evidence that indicated this was a place where children, little children, might gather. Nothing, except for a Kit Kat clock. I don't know who the hell put it there, but above the door hung a Kit Kat clock. I'd watch the eyes shift from side to side in syncopation with the tail and wish those hands would spin like a roulette wheel. That clock gave me hope. The clock gave me some small assurance, an indication that I was sitting in a school and not a state correctional facility. It made such a lasting impression on me that today I own two Kit Kat clocks. I was only about six, and so when the battle axe nun took attendance and these other kids answered, "Present," I recall thinking, "Present? I have no present for this prune-faced hag. Why the fuck would I give her a present?" I probably didn't think fuck back then. It took years for my vocabulary to reach the Oxford level it has now attained. But it was surely some word of similar import to a six-year-old. And so when she called Lawrence Blydner, I answered, "Here." And she glared at me. "The correct response to roll call is present." And then this cute little girl, I'll never forget her. Her name was Laura Donatello. Oh, she looked like one of those angels on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. Her face was just two big cheeks and shiny brown eyes, and she was a little angel. I wanted to grab her hand, and maybe wings would sprout out of her back, and she could fly the two of us out of this hellhole. Little Laura raises her hand and says in her baby voice, "I have to go to the bathroom." And Sister Testosterone says, "Hold it. Recess is in 30 minutes. Laura was in distress. She says,
"But I feel thick."
And Sister Testosterone says, "Make it fast." And so Laura claps a pudgy baby hand over her mouth and runs out of the room. Well, she never made it to the bathroom. We all heard her heaving in the hallway. We could actually hear the splash of her upchuck on the tiled floor. Laura came back a couple minutes later, still looking green. No sympathy from Sister Testosterone. Now, the next day I went off to school, this time only accompanied by my older brother. With only two thoughts in my head, how do I run away with the circus or get my hands on a weapon? And for some forgotten reason, we were a little bit late. My brother went off to his classroom, and damn, I could not remember where the hell my room was. I hesitated at the top of the warped stone steps, trying to get my bearings. Do I go left or right? Do I follow the sound of creepy prayers or some kid screaming as he's having his ass paddled by a sadistic nun? Before I could make up my mind, I got knocked sideways, sucker punched. I turned around, and standing over me is a big, angry penguin. Sister Rose Aquinas, school principal. I'd been in a few scraps with other kids before, but nobody ever sucker slapped me upside my head, and certainly no adult. And as I sort of got my head again, she grabbed a fistful of my hair. I felt pain and rage. There was an older kid that lived down the street from me, Susie, and she once grabbed a fistful of my hair. And she let go rather quickly when I drove my fist deep into her solar plexus. So if it worked on Susie, maybe it would work on this penguin. I let her have it. But Sister Rose Aquinas outweighed me by at least 150. And with all that black and white canvas uniform, my right jab had little effect other than to piss her off even more. Now, outraged and shocked by my daring to defend myself, she shrieked and slapped me hard. The other penguins heard the ruckus, and rather quickly reinforcements arrived. Several more he-women in habits. But I refused to capitulate. I kept throwing lefts, rights, and combinations. Max Kellerman should have been ringside, doing the round by round. And little Blydner is hopelessly outclassed, but he's trying to give as good as he gets. A penguin throws a left. Whoa, he slips it and comes back with an uppercut, but oh, it misses. If this kid had the reach to match his moxie, there'd be penguins on the floor. And another penguin grabs him in a clinch, and look at Blydner's knee action. Oh, the judges are sure to clip him some points for that. There should have been pointy ring girls in bikinis and ankle straps. But the fight only went one short round. I knew I couldn't hold on much longer. So I saw an opening, and I booked like a track star down that gloomy hall with penguins giving chase. But they, in their sensible shoes and swollen ankles, were no match for me. I burst through the doors, onto the street, and didn't stop running until I was home. So what happened? Why'd I get sucker punched? Well, at that time I was a little bit big for my age, more the size of a second or third grader. And allegedly there was another red-headed third grader who was chronically truant. And so when the head penguin saw me standing on that landing, she mistook me for him. She thought she was entitled to slug first and ask questions later. That was the official explanation, with some weak-ass apology anyway. When I think back on that incident, I wonder why I didn't become a serial killer for Dominican nuns. As the weeks and months wore on, the grim brutality was taking its toll. We all developed our defense mechanisms. Mine was my imagination. I'd sit there and envision unspeakable acts of violence on the nuns. Little Laura Donatella developed an upset stomach that would erupt with the regularity of Old Faithful. At least two mornings a week, somewhere around 10 o'clock by the Kit Kat clock. Laura would clap a pudgy baby hand over her pudgy baby mouth and make a run for the bathroom. She'd be gone for a few minutes and then return. I don't know if she was actually sick or just created a way to give herself a 10-minute break from penguin hell. And so one morning, Laura runs for the bathroom. And who should appear at the door at that precise moment but Sister Rosie Quinas. She was kind of a ringer for Large Marge of Pee Wee Herman fame. Sounded a lot like her, too. And she stood there blocking Laura's path. She looks down at Laura and says, "What's the matter with you?" And Laura says,
"My stomach's upset."
And Rosie says,
"What did you eat for breakfast, young lady?"
And Laura answers,
"Milk and cookies."
And just like that, Rosie winds up and slaps Laura so hard she staggers the kid. A handprint welt rose on Laura's face like it was red neon.
"You get yourself a proper breakfast from now on. Get back in your seat."
Well, scenes like that don't happen today, certainly not in America. And if they did, there'd be cops and lawyers and cover-ups. Oh, lots of cover-ups. And then therapy and anger management and mood-leveling drugs administered and so forth. And, well, as I retell that story, I can't help but revert to my old defense mechanism, my imagination, and all those civilized ways to treat or punish sick fucks, those who would abuse children, I hereby roundly reject. If I could buckle myself in the time machine and return to that scene and deck that twisted hag the moment before she tagged that baby girl, I most certainly would. Now, I can throw a punch. Most guys can. But, you know, in athletics, the difference between an amateur or even a gifted amateur and a champion is vast. Not just a few degrees of proficiency or experience. It's, well, they're really galaxies apart. I love boxing. It's the only pro sport I follow, and in my career I've had the opportunity to get up close and personal with some world champions. Their speed and power is almost incomprehensible. It does not translate via HDTV or even two rows removed from ringside. But when your feet are on the canvas, just on the safe side of the ropes, then you can actually feel the percussion of their punches. They are truly explosive. And that's when you realize those guys' hands really are deadly weapons. And so, let me buckle into that time machine, but accompanied by a professional, right? Somebody who can really get the job done. How about Floyd Mayweather, or maybe Triple G, or Canelo Alvarez, or one of those lethal middleweights? I could see Floyd rising from a desk in the back. You know, he walks to Rosie, he adjusts his bling, and then just with a right cross, so fast you can't see it, he takes Rosie's chin clean off. The lower jaw is gone. She stands there like some wrecked Pez dispenser. And then I tell Rosie, "You know, sister, from now on you'll be on a liquid diet. But you will save a lot on lipstick. Oh, no, wait, that's right. You don't date. But you'll also save on dental work, as you'll only have half your teeth now. And oh, one more thing. You won't be hitting any defenseless babies anymore, will you, sister? Hey, Floyd, just grab her by that dangling tongue and nod her head for her." Instant, lethal, or crippling retribution. Wouldn't that be better than all the legal bullshit? As you can see, my very earliest school experiences may have colored my opinions about certain educational institutions and the species who ran them. High school, another Catholic institution, and all boys, wasn't much different. College was okay. There were girls there, pointy ones. And it was actually kind of fun. Nobody needed any safe spaces back then. In fact, the safest space was probably the Rathskeller with Miller High Life on tap and a bar with every spirit you could want. It was great. When I think back, it's the jobs I had, the oddball, non-corporate, non-suit, part-time jobs, especially while in college and shortly out of college, that I look back on most fondly. For a few years, I was frontman for a country western band, the Cadillac Cowboys. I and my partner, Pontiac Pete, covered damn near everything by Waylon and Willie, Merle, George Jones, the Eagles, and so on. We had a rotation of sidemen that were pretty amazing. Guys that had toured with some big acts and somehow found themselves with us. We were the house band at a honky-tonk in Nassau County, Long Island. They served pizza, burgers, and long-necked buds and whiskey, lots and lots of whiskey. The crowd was a melange of humanity. Middle-aged women with cotton candy hair and polka dot polyester and their similarly attired dates and husbands. There was a good number of college kids like us and always a small squadron of Hell's Angels. I always thought those guys dug metal, but I was wrong. So we were a band of five. Bass, rhythm, lead, pedal steel, and drums. Oh yeah, our drummer only had one leg. Sometimes he'd count us in by smacking the sticks on his wooden thigh. Plenty of times, guys would wander in with a fiddle or a guitar and ask if they could sit in, and they would. And I realized back then there was far more undiscovered talent out there than you could ever imagine. One rainy night, a kid came in, said he had a Strat in his car. Could he maybe bring it in and sit in with us for a tune or two? Pete and I were a little bit leery. We'd never seen him before, and Strats were rarely the choice of country pickers. They usually prefer Tellys because of their unmistakable twang and the way they cut like a knife. So we said sure. He comes back in and pulls out a snow-white Stratocaster. Our lead guitarist, Fast Frankie, gives us a look, unplugs his Telly, and hands the jack to the Strat kid. The kid asks if we do any Eagles. Sure, I tell him. Well, he just blasts right into Life in the Fast Lane, and our jaws drop. The kid was no Joe Walsh. He was Joe Walsh and Don Felder, and oh my God, he could run a riff for days. After a while, Pete and I just sat down and let the bass and drummer back the guy. He was as good as any guitar player I have ever seen or heard. And we're thinking, who is this kid? He must play for the greatest of the greats, or maybe he's one of those session guys, but he's so damn young. So we asked him. He only played in his basement, his parents' basement. And then he starts to put away his Strat, and we're like, no, you can't leave now. Stay, play, have a beer, we're buying. He politely declined because his dad was picking him up out front in a minute or two. He walked out the front door like a guitar hero, Hell's Angels backslapping him as he went out into the rainy night, and we never saw him again. Even now, when I hear some totally original, blistering country riff, I stop and I wonder, is that him? Who was he? Fronting a band was a blast, especially after the second set when the crowd would start to get well-oiled. You never knew when a fist fight would break out or some groupie. Yeah, we actually had a couple, even in that little dive. Some groupie would request to help me make it through the night and then volunteer. So one night, I look out from our little stage we played on and I see three guys who stick out like turds in a punch bowl. They look more like Sinatra fans, maybe Tony Spumante's crew. They're wearing car coats and plenty of 14-carat rope gold. And I'm wondering, has Tony come to see me perform? That wasn't his style. And to Tony, country music was torture. We finish our set, and the one guy comes up to me and says, hey, you guys play good. I thank him and head for the kitchen. Hey, wait a minute. I want to ask you about something. Now, two of these guys are in their 40s. The third one's early 20s. And I'm trying to figure out what's coming. And the talker introduces himself. He's Johnny, and tells me, like I said, you and your band got a good sound, but it could be better. Yeah, well, this isn't the grand old Opry, you know.
What's that?
Says Johnny, country western aficionado.
So what your band really needs is an organ.
An organ?
Yeah, an organ, you know, like Booker T. And the MJs.
Hey, we kind of like our sound the way it is, Johnny. You know, country. Now the guy gets testy and pushy. And he says,
no, you need an organ, and my nephew is going to play with you.
And the nephew sticks out his pinky-ringed hand and says, hi, I'm Eugene. I play the organ. I can't believe this. I'm getting muscled by some fucktard low-rent wise guy who wants me to add his organ-playing punk nephew to my country band. So I say, listen, I'm sure you play a mean organ, Eugene, but have you ever heard a country band with an organ in it? That's kind of like a tuba in a rock band, you know? That's when Johnny gets right in my face and says, I don't think you're hearing me. You need an organ player, understand? Here's a little tip from the senseis at the Take No Shit Dojo. Should you find yourself in a negotiation like this, where you're outnumbered, unless you're in imminent danger, stall. Stall until you've got the advantage. So I tell him, okay, Eugene, come back next week. I'll have a set list. You can learn her songs and then rehearse with us. How's that? And Johnny slaps Eugene on the back and says, You see
how easy?
And these three assholes fade. Well, next day, I'm on Tony Spumante's L-shaped sectional crushed velour couch. He sparks a cool. Who the fuck are those assholes? What'd they look like? Maybe they were the crew I know out there in Hempstead. Let me make some calls. Johnny and Eugene, huh? You get any last names? I hadn't. I'll send Joey and Mikey out to see them at your honky-tonk. He'll break Eugene's organ in three pieces and shove them up their assholes. Every time they'll shit, they'll hear Ave fucking Maria. And I'm thinking, I really don't want to get into this. What if Eugene's handlers are with a crew Tony doesn't know? And next week there's a bunch of bullet-ridden corpses, maybe mine among them. How the hell do I fix this without bloodshed or walking away from my nice, fun gig? And who would have thought I'd face this kind of bullshit over a silly little gig that barely paid the gas money to get to it? I had something of an anxiety-ridden week. And finally, next Friday rolled around. Somewhere into the second set, I see Eugene and Johnny. The third asshole wasn't there. I ask Eugene if he knows the set list. He grunts, and then I tell him, you know, Eugene, before you start rehearsing with us, which we do three nights a week, that was bullshit, we don't pay for rehearsal time, and we split the take each night, which means you'll be getting $25 a night. We start at 9 and play till 1:30. Now, by now, Johnny has joined us, and I can see the look of disbelief. He thought he was muscling Eugene into a gold mine. That moment, old Ed, the owner, comes out of the kitchen, wiping his hands on a towel. And asshole Johnny asks him right out,
hey, I manage a band. What do you pay a night?
$125, says Ed.
Are you kidding me?
This ain't the Grand Ole Opry, says Ed. Johnny and Eugene glare at each other and disappear. Never saw them again. Now, you can't buy that kind of job experience at any school on the planet. And so people are asking, what about school? Is it worth it? And the answer is an unequivocal maybe. Vast portions of my high school time and effort were put into merely passing subjects in which I had zero interest, like chemistry. I found chemistry the most boring and impossible subject, and yet I was forced to struggle through 2 years of it. But that's the way schools work. They have no interest in developing successful people, only in force-feeding information, much of it utterly useless. And then the pinhead academic's argument is,
why, you must get a sampling of it to know what you like.
Really? After 10 minutes of valences and covalence bonding, I had all the chemistry I needed to know that I hated it. But they knew better, didn't they? There are few professions with more arrogance per square skull than academia, And that's why I hold so very few academics in any degree of esteem whatsoever. They live in a cushy bubble, not unlike government bureaucrats, virtually fireproof, guaranteed lifetime employment, often free housing, and marginal, if any, accountability. And every day, a captive audience of students, whose only way to tell them what incompetent, arrogant gasbags they are is to flame them on some Rate My Teacher website. Tenured professors never get what the rest of us get out here in the real world. Fired. Or maybe somebody just telling them, hey, stupid. Maybe that should become a thing, an experiment in phenomenology. Walk up to some pompous, elbow-patched, tenured windbag and say, hello, stupid. Grab it on video and post it online. Fuck the mannequin challenge. Take the hello, stupid challenge. But look deeper. Look deeper. What are they teaching? What is smart? Oh, we could do another entire show on what is smart. Schools and academics think smart is the absorption and regurgitation of information. Well, by that definition, anybody's smartphone is dramatically smarter than they are. Can anybody's head hold 256 gigs of data, access it instantaneously and faithfully? Schools are not really interested in wisdom, and there's a vast difference between knowledge and wisdom. No, schools want to create Jeopardy contestants. Steve Jobs, Richard Branson, Larry Ellison, Michael Dell, even Bill Gates, not one of those guys finished college. There's a private school, kindergarten through 12th grade, not too far away from me, and they charge $35,000 a year tuition. And one would ask, have to ask, any parent of any kid attending that school, are you smarter than a fifth grader? No, you're kind of a rich idiot. Now more than ever before, because public schools have become such shitholes, private schools are into serious, full-on marketing. And more than ever before, schools are a for-profit business. Harvard has a $36 billion with a B endowment. There has to be some kind of math guy out there who can support or shoot down this hypothesis, that I would imagine that the interest on $36 billion could make that a tuition-free school forever. Not that I'm an advocate of free tuition. I'm not. But there are damn few global conglomerates that have amassed a $36 billion war chest. Hell, my dog has never been to school, but he's smarter than a lot of people. He only eats when he's hungry, so his weight never fluctuates. If he's tired, he takes a nap. Never drinks too much, doesn't smoke, stretches when he wakes up, insists I play tug-of-war and throw a ball for him to chase, so he gets all the exercise he needs. He even knows to only throw down with other dogs he can take. He's a little guy, so he never barks at pit bulls or Rottweilers. He knows his limitations. When he meets someone he likes, he rubs up against him and licks him. When it's a creep, he follows his doggy instincts and growls or stays away. There used to be a common phrase about education. They'd refer to some high school student and say he or she is or is not college material. And those who were not, those who lacked the intellect or the desire, would pursue vocations. Carpenters, electricians, steam fitters, masons, heavy equipment operators, whatever. And what the fuck was wrong with that? How wrong has our society gone that it's assumed that some dude driving a bulldozer is inferior to somebody flying a desk? I knew a guy who operated huge cranes. He made a couple hundred grand a year every year. Loved every minute of his job. And unlike his white-collar neighbors, who lived in comparable homes, drove comparable cars, and had comparable standards of living, the suits all had ulcers and therapists and needed Zoloft to get through their days. They still say someone is Olympic material, don't they, though? You hear that one all the time. And nobody seems to think that it's wrong or mean or exclusionary, do they? Why is that? Because athletics, most athletics, are finite. You can't finesse or massage or bullshit a clock or a yardstick, can you? When some guy springs up on that pole and doesn't quite make it over the bar, he missed it. That's it. Black or white, success or failure, no gray area. But in our fucked up participation trophy culture, everybody's now college material. And academia has constructed a vast Byzantine system of head fakes and smoke screens where failure and subpar performance can hide, beginning with, quote, grading on a curve, unquote. What a load of shit. Would a builder frame a house on a curve? How would you like a quad bypass from a doctor who made it through med school on a curve? And now, academia has brought those failure bunkers above ground and named them safe spaces. As much as I loathed Sister Testosterone, maybe she was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Maybe college campuses need people like her today. When alleged adults become career liars and infants, she steps up to them and, bam, loosens their teeth with five across the lip. Not with kids, but with adults. Sometimes violence is the answer. The entire status construct of college, especially Ivy League schools, oh, the perceived prestige of the Ivy League. Well, some of the dumbest people I've ever met are Ivy League grads. And you know plenty of them, too. Lots of them lived at the White House. Okay, so now we'll address a specific school question left on the answering machine here at the Take No Shit Dojo. Have a listen to William's dilemma. He's a U.S. Army vet, now out of the service, but pursuing a bachelor's degree.
For the past about 2 years, I've been working on my bachelor's degree. I'd like to know if it's wasted effort. Now, my degree is in geography. What's more marketable? Is it someone's experience or is it someone's education?
What a fantastic question from William, to whom I will not say thank you for your service. That's become such a pukey cliche it makes my skin crawl. I'll just thank William for manning up and hope while in the Army, you got to kick some enemy ass. So experience versus education is utterly contingent upon timing. For a guy like you just starting out, employers are going to demand a degree before they'll even look at you, or more likely a master's of some type. However, if you manage to assemble a body of work while in the service, your thing is geography, right? If you can point to some portfolio of cartographic masterpieces, that'll give you a leg up on all the new grads who have nothing to offer but a sheepskin. Later on in your career, education becomes virtually meaningless. Does anyone give a shit if or where Bonamassa learned to play the guitar? Or that Bill Gates dropped out of college? No. So dig deep and see what you've got to leverage into a gig. And unfortunately, the bachelor's is a must at your stage. Here's another quick call from a guy who prefers the mysterious pseudonym Omega. He seems to like his field okay, audio engineer, but is stuck in a company full of assholes. Let's hear Omega's problem.
I freelance on the side sometimes, and the money's good, but it's not regular enough to keep the lights on. For full-time gigs, like I have, competition's tough, and the market's flooded with idiots who claim to be audio engineers. Currently, I'm running the daily grind and doing what I can to find other work, but I haven't been able to make much progress in that. Got any advice? Thanks, Larry.
An audio engineer is one of those fields that's as much art as it is science, right? And so what you need to do, Omega, is, through your freelance work, snag an assignment that has what we at the dojo call marquee appeal. What is that? It's when you do a job for some person or company of elevated stature, and the moment you do, some of that stature rubs off on you. You didn't narrow the area you work in, but let's say you record or engineer radio spots for a local deli. Nobody gives a shit. But maybe you know a guy that owns a McDonald's, Offer to do a job for him at a cut rate if you have to, and boom, now you are an engineering audio for an international conglomerate. And doesn't that look a lot sexier on a resume than the Main Street delicatessen? Once you get a couple of gigs like that under your belt, you ratchet yourself into a league above those fake competitors you so revile. Keep doing that, and the jobs will start coming to you instead of you having to scrounge them up. And maybe you can fire your current employer. Maybe drive him to a shitty neighborhood and boot his ass out of your car. Hey, we're almost out of time. Thanks for listening, everyone. I cannot believe how this show is catching on. Listeners are popping up from all over the world. Special thanks to the marvelous folks who keep this show going through Patreon. We love you. Give us a call anytime at 302-71-LARRY. Or drop us an email at thatlarryshow@gmail.com. Or tweet us or Facebook us. Visit us anytime at the Take No Shit Dojo. What's the address? You can't miss it. It's right at the crossroads of madness and enlightenment. See you next time.